That may not work right there. Put a vest on, and that makes it difficult. There we go. How many of you saw the Bin Laden tape? Everybody. Wonderful. Almost everybody. You know that there are people claiming it's a fake. And those people probably believe that the moonshots didn't take place but were faked out in the Arizona desert, and they're probably also members of the Flat Earth Society. But there are people who, no matter what proof you showed them, if, for example, Bin Laden were standing in front of a tribunal of generals who had the power of life and death and confessed, there are Arabs who would say, he is lying. He is merely doing it to become a martyr to save and to protect the real criminals who did it. I mean, that's the mindset of people. You know what kind of a war we're really fighting? We are in a war for men's minds. We are in a war for the possession of human brains, human minds. I want to turn to the 12th chapter of the book of Revelation and illustrate a point that we tend to forget about, although I try to remind us every now and then. It says, verse 7, there was war in heaven. So war is pretty much universal, isn't it? You look out into the universe and you see the wreckage of space. We've been going through the Leonid meteor shower, and that is a part of that wreckage. All those jagged rocks came from somewhere. They weren't just created in that shape. They were created in the form of planets and so on that later on exploded. And all of that dust and debris is out there. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. The possessive pronoun there tells me that since there are only three archangels mentioned in the Bible, Lucifer, Michael, and Gabriel, that God divided up a number of who knows how many millions of angelic creatures and beings, angels, messengers, that are powerful, and they dwell in a spirit realm, and that each one of these archangels was the custodian, was the leader over his one-third of the angels. Now, I've talked about the trafficking and how the devil went about as a, quote, salesman, and I'm wondering if it didn't take a few thousand years or a few million years for Satan the devil to actually corrupt and pollute the minds of all of those who followed him and looked up to his beauty and his power, and that it wasn't just like divine fiat or a fait accompli instantly, but that Lucifer had to subvert and to reach the minds of even these powerful spirits over whom he was the chief. Because it seems to say Michael and his angels, meaning that Michael's angels, and Michael is called Michael, your prince, the prince of the Israelitish people, the 12 tribes of Israel in the book of Daniel. And so they are faithful and loyal to Michael, who is faithful and loyal to God. And Gabriel and his angels are faithful and loyal to Gabriel, who is faithful and loyal to God. And prevailed not, verse 8, neither was their place found any more in heaven. When I looked into, in my college years, theosophy and the likes of the Fox sisters and Madame Blavatsky and the American Theosophic Society, and looked into this woman who was an immigrant Russian and looked at the pictures of her eyes and her face and read some of the stuff by William James, America's famous philosopher, who himself, I believe, was demon-possessed, who allegedly wrote under a spell or like a trance where his hand would actually move over the paper, didn't know what he was doing, and came back out of the trance, and there were written words there, some kind of a message that he received. Well, I became absolutely convinced by all the things that I read. By, for example, a book called Let Us In. What an interesting title. And in a chapter inside the book was a chapter titled Take Us In. Now, I only read bits and pieces of it, but I certainly read that chapter. And I mean, it raised goose flesh and hair standing straight up. And I didn't like it very much. It was almost like being in some dank place with a wretched smell and being in fear that you were reading something which was absolutely tainted. And it talked about exalted spirits in India and other countries and talking about millions of them. I have no reason to doubt that. That's why I think that as those aircraft were banking and as those fanatical Arabs were at the controls, that there were giggling demons that were going whoop-dee-dee and just looking with delight at what was about to happen, and were right there because they just were impervious, and as they saw bits and pieces of body parts disintegrating and exploding in front of their eyes, they probably rejoiced. Now, here is a demoniacal idiot wrapped in his turban, sitting on the floor in a bunch of blankets, no furniture in the room, giggling, chortling, happy over mass death. Burning, dismemberment, explosions, destruction of human life. How did he come to that place? How do people reach a stage in life where they have zero conscience? Adolf Hitler, on the day that the top leader of the SS came to the Berghaus and his high Aerie down there in the Bavarian Alps, and it was a beautiful day, and her name was Trudel, T-R-U-D-L, I forget, but he had a favorite German shepherd there. And on the very day that he was told about the pogroms beginning and how effective the final solution was beginning to be, and that the ovens were there, and that the gas chambers were there, and they were being used, and thousands and hundreds of thousands of Jews were now being processed, Hitler turned to the dog and scratched her behind the ears and said that he's just got to look after that dog. He'd been neglecting her. She looked like she was a little underweight. I guess I haven't been feeding you well lately. Unbelievable. When I saw that, I had all sorts of emotions. I didn't need the smoking gun, because when I walked up the gangway into the airport in Little Rock after being forced to land there on 9/11 and saw the towers collapsing, I said, Bin Laden, because I knew who was behind the coal bombing and the Khobar towers and the original attempt on the Twin Trade Towers and the other bombings in both Kenya and Dar es Salaam. So I understood who it was from the beginning. Now I know. Let me tell you something probably hard for you to understand. You know, when Bin Laden was a little bitty baby about Gage's age, or about the age of my youngest grandchild, little Hunter, I'll bet he was a cute little kid. What do you think? I bet he was a cute little brown-eyed kid. I'll bet his mother just thought he was precious. And as she nursed him and as he learned to toddle and took his first step, I'll bet his daddy and his mom just were gleeful over the little kid. Now, what did they teach him? What chance did he have? I'm not apologizing for him. I'm saying, think about the fact that a five-year-old Vietnamese speaks better Vietnamese than you do. We sneeze alike, but they speak Vietnamese because they're taught that. If they from the cradle had been in your family, they'd speak English. If your baby had been given to them, they'd speak Vietnamese. So they are therefore taught from the earliest recollections, whatever it is that their parents decide to funnel in their ready little brain, which is just exactly like a blank hard disk in a hard drive in a computer, which is ready to be programmed. And as you program it, garbage in, garbage out, they will believe exactly what they are told by their parents. Education is that process by which the older generation instills its fables, its traditions, its lies, its distorted history, its politics, its religions into the unsuspecting minds of its coming generation. It is not true, not here, not in England, not in Afghanistan, not in Saudi Arabia. It is a perverted twist on the truth every single time. Education itself is a perverted, not a science, but a perverted method of trying to instill the propaganda of all of these various social institutions into the minds of people. Now, unlike Bin Laden, when I was a little boy, and I saw some of these things happening, I've told you time and again that I was very much against church politics. Why? Well, because I saw it all around me from age 5. I learned to detest it. When I got to be a teenager, I rejected my dad's religion. I hated the Sabbath. I hated everything about that old clapboard church outside the city limits with outhouses instead of flushing toilets in Eugene, Oregon. I didn't like being a so-called preacher's kid. I challenged every bit of it. Drove my mother wild, oftentimes to tears, said the very same words that a gentleman said to my son the other day. Well, who does Garner Ted think he is to be right? And all these other churches, I suppose, are wrong. And so I would say, well, who does my dad, why can't it be Delmer Jeske's dad? How come my dad, this is a really stupid statement, what gives him the right to be right, I said. Why me? How come me? How come my dad, of all the human beings on the face of the earth, says, I've got the truth? Well, nonsense, I said to myself. That can't be, simply because I'm me. Therefore, that can't be happening to me. Unlike what some people think, I know about Oral and Richard, but I did not just swallow the party line. I wasn't programmed. I was in school. I was as absolutely much a part of the Oregon school system and my peers in school as anybody else. I won't belabor this to tell you about how I went out with a bar of soap and enjoyed Halloween, or how I had my little private Christmas in the garage pretending and play acting and all that because it was kept from me by my parents. But I did not simply absorb all that I believe today without an awful lot of kicking and screaming, without an awful lot of obstacles to overcome, without an awful lot of doubt and suspicion, and having to come at it from a completely different point of view than most people do. Because I wasn't buying my dad's what I would call party line or propaganda. I had to look at it with Herbert W. Armstrong straight in front of me as an obstacle to be overcome. Not as a man. It says a prophet hath no honor in his own house, doesn't it? That was true of my dad. My sister Dottie, God bless her, she's wonderful, I love her, she's 80 years of age, she's not in God's church. She never accepted it. She still can't get rid of her animosity toward her father, and he's been dead for 15 years. Now what I'm telling you is for a purpose, because there is a great war for men's minds. It's all about mind control. It begins with youths, little babies, and there are those powers and those people in the world today, like the Jim Joneses of the world, who are trying to control men's minds. It says here, they prevailed not, verse 8, neither was their place found anymore in heaven, and the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world, except some people would say, me. Well, they're wrong. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. We don't know how many of them there are, uncounted millions. I heard a voice saying in heaven, now is come salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ, intimating that after the casting down of Satan the devil, the actual establishment of the kingdom of Christ must be something to happen pretty swiftly thereafter. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. An endless vitriol of you. He did, she did, just accusing you and me and everyone else. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, their experiences, the way it is to them, how they were converted, what they've learned, the truth that they understand. And they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you having great wrath, because he knows that he has but a short time. The devil knows what is awaiting him. He wants to forestall it. He still, in his perverted way, is hoping to avoid it somehow. Now, I know that there are vicious demons who actually, I've heard some of them talk on an occasion. I remember one of them that snappily said to my father, well, judge, and called him judge, and he commanded the demon to come out, and the woman became normal. I won't tell you who that was, but I remember it very well. And I know that such creatures exist, and I want to go into my own experience again, being grabbed by one many years ago, but I'll guarantee you it is not something you want to repeat. So I'm here to tell you that there is a great archdemon who is waging a war for the control of human minds. And I want you to understand what is happening in the minds and the lives of little Arab boys. Did you happen to see on Fox News the front page of one of the leading New York dailies the other day? It showed about five or six of these turbaned and masked, they were all wearing white, adult Arabs, terrorists. And each one of them had a great big belt of Semtex in like bricks, like a great big belt around their waist, and were carrying an AK-47. Little bitty cute toddler was right down there below them. And he was standing there dressed exactly like they were, except he was the only one whose face was shown. The rest of them just had slits like this and had the white turbans all over their face. And he also was wearing a belt of Semtex or explosives. And they were proudly teaching this little guy, who obviously adores his elders, loves his daddy, Muhammad, Abdullah Muhammad, whatever his name might be, and loves his mother and loves his play kids and the brothers and sisters and on, and they're perverting and twisting this little kid into wanting to be a suicide bomber. Now, this is a religion that worships death, that is fixated on death, and wants death to come to them as soon as possible, but in a particular way, through martyrdom. But a different kind of martyrdom than you and I think about. You and I generally think about life as precious, to be enjoyed, a life which is fruitful and abundant, and a life of accomplishment, a life of success, a life of things like happiness, and a life with joy and excitement. And we want to live as long as possible. We want to put off death as long as possible. I don't care if you're 80, 85, 90, still like to have a lot more years if possible. I'm hoping for a good 15, 17, 20 good active years yet. I know I don't have a lot more than 20 or so. It'd be ridiculous. I'm already living very close to my allotted, well, I'm over my allotted time. I'm over 70. But that is the Christian religion. We know that death is conquered of Christ, and we know that through Christ we can conquer death, and we know that there is life after death, and we know that it can be instantaneous so far as our awareness of the passage of time is concerned, but we don't relish the thought of going there just right now or right now today. And God understands that. He's put that within our nature. Listen to this. This is a website that is run by one Sheikh Abdullah Azam the First. Praise be to Allah, Lord of the universe, and peace and blessings be upon the leader and the prophets and commander of the Mujahideen, Muhammad, S-A-W-S, and upon all his companions and whoever pursues their method, follows their way, and wages jihad until the day of judgment. I'll skip along and give you some of the particulars here. A small group, they're the ones let me just go back one paragraph. As for those who build nations, they are few in number. Sometimes it can be a single individual who makes a stand by means of which Allah rescues this project, Deem they call it, and made a stand. He mentioned an Arab named Bakr who made a stand on the day of apostasy. That's mentioned in the Quran. And the day when Imam Ahmad bin Ad or somebody made a stand when the entire world was speechless at the innovation that the Quran created, so Allah saved the Ummah with him. A small group, they are the ones who carry convictions and ambitions. And an even smaller group from this group are the ones who flee from the worldly life in order to see and act upon these ambitions. And an even smaller group from this elite group are the ones who sacrifice their souls and their blood in order to bring victory to these ambitions and pursue it. So they are the cream of the cream of the cream. It is not possible to reach glory except through this body. Let me go on and give you just a part of this now. It says that the martyr will immediately enter paradise at the first drop of his blood that spurts from his body. Even before his soul leaves his body, he tastes the sweetness of iman. He is married to 72 of the beautiful maidens. He is protected from the punishment of the grave. He is saved from the great terror of the day of judgment. There is placed upon his head a crown of honor, a jewel of which more than the whole world, of which is worth more than the whole world and everything in it, and he is granted permission to intercede on behalf of the members of his household to bring them into paradise and save them from hell. It actually says that with the first spurt of his blood, even before his soul has left his body, he will actually see all of this, and he will enter paradise. It quotes the Quran and says, all these are ones whom Allah has guided, so follow their guidance, and also quotes the Quran saying, indeed, Allah has purchased from the believers their lives and their possessions in paradise. They fight in the way of Allah, they kill and are killed. Quran 9111. Interesting numbers. 9111. O youths, O sons of Islam, what will cleanse our sins? What will purify our mistakes and what will clean our dirt? It will not be washed except with the blood of martyrdom, and there is no path except this path. If not, then the accountability will be difficult and hell awaits. The bridge is ready. They have manufactured in their religion an idea of a bridge over hell that you can cross and escape it. And your time is running out, so consider it. That is Islam. That is what they teach those little children. And there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of them, of all ages, from 3 and 5 and 9, little toddlers on up to what we'd say are elementary school kids, who are just volunteering in scores and hundreds, who want to grow up to be a martyr. You know what that says, if you read it carefully? It says each one of them can become a savior. That by the shedding of his blood, he can enter paradise and turn around and give his family entry into paradise. So they're actually preempting Christ. Now, when the idiot known as Muhammad, the liar, the satanic, demonic, possessed idiot known as Muhammad, concocted his mishmash of religion, he decided to superpose it upon everything that the Christian religion stood for and everything that the Jewish religion stood for. He made himself into the last prophet 600 years after Christ, and therefore, since he was the last one and the ultimate one, there would not be any more after him. He was the greatest one. He then decided Jesus Christ was a prophet, but just one of the many prophets, like Joel or Amos. He said, yes, Ibrahim, he was a good man, he was a great man, one of the patriarchs. They acknowledged the Old Testament patriarchs. They acknowledged many of the other people who were mentioned as some of the martyrs of the Bible and the patriarchs, and they actually say that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were real people. They believe that. They believe bits and pieces of the Old Testament. But he decided not only that, but to superpose his religion atop that of Christ and the Jewish religion by putting both the Old and New Testament together, borrowing bits and pieces of it, putting his own spin on it, plus the paganism from his native land of Saudi Arabia, and then concocting a whole new concept of religion. Now, whoever it was that he said, you must tell this after I die, we don't know, but it probably is ascertainable. And they began the myth that Muhammad ascended directly to heaven while he was yet alive from the Harm el Sharif, or the place that is called the Dome of the Rock. Now, to the Jews, they will tell you when you go there, any cab driver will, any Jewish tourist guide will tell you that the Dome of the Rock sits atop the very Mount Moriah that was the site of Abraham's near sacrifice of Isaac. They believe that. Then the Christians will tell you that that is the site of Christ's ascension to heaven. They believe that. So it becomes the holiest of the holy places to the three great monotheistic religions, with Muhammad coming along and superposing his religion atop the earlier Jewish religion and a somewhat later Christian religion, and him saying that his is the newest and the last, never to be superseded, and so all these people just swallow it and they believe it. I don't know how in the world you convince an older person of Islam, except that there is some kind of a void in their lives that they've got to fill somehow. Now, I don't want to belabor this next comment I'm going to make, but I probably shouldn't even make it, so I'll just desist. But nevertheless, you look at an awful lot of American citizens who go for Islam and you wonder why, and how can an adult go for that kind of thing? It's because there's a void in their lives. It's because whatever it is that they've experienced before doesn't satisfy, hasn't answered the ultimate questions that they have. Who am I? What am I? What am I all about? What should I be doing with my life? What happens when I die? What is the great master plan for the universe? And they haven't been able to put together the idea of the immortality of the soul and the ever-burning hell and going to heaven immediately when you die. It doesn't answer all their questions, so they seek elsewhere. My elder sister, Beverly, had hundreds of books. And rejecting my father's religion, she sought answers in Oriental religions and even in Middle and Near Eastern theology and philosophy. She had hundreds of books on religion and philosophy. And she read the likes of writers in the Hindu religion or the Islamic religion or the Buddhist religion. And she read philosophers like Kant and Epictetus. And she would read people like Freud. I think she devoured that book. And she read all this stuff, seeking for answers. She never came to that answer in her lifetime until she was almost ready to die and asked me, Ted, what's going to happen to me? And I opened up 1 Corinthians 15 and read it to her. She'd heard it before, way back when she was a girl, I'm sure. But I think it did give her some comfort in her last days and weeks on this earth. And I told her, Beverly, it's just going to be like the next split second. You're going to wake up and you'll be in God's kingdom. Don't worry about it. I didn't go into the first and second resurrection. I just told her that that's what's going to happen. And that's what it says right here in a moment of the twinkling of an eye. The last trump, the dead shall be raised, and that she is going to come up and we'll see her again. I don't understand how adult human beings can follow a Jim Jones. We dealt with that way back when it happened. I don't know how this guy named whatever Bread Weight or what his name was, I've forgotten his name now, over in San Diego, convinced these people to join the mothership in a Kahootek comet and to spread plastic over their faces and strangle themselves to death, making sure that their driver's licenses were there so they could drive their own little spaceship away. I don't understand the idiocy of an adult human mind that can be so thwarted, so frustrated, and so empty that they will admit that kind of stuff into their minds unless I crank in a spiritual factor. I don't know that it's all mental. I think that maybe some of it is spiritual. And I think that a very motivated demon and a human being who is demon-influenced and or possessed can motivate other people. Remember my sermon way back called Just One Man? You've seen some of the foam-flecked speeches of Adolf Hitler and saying, you know, the Deutschland über alles and all of that. I won't try to demonstrate that, but it'd probably break the microphone. But Adolf Hitler absolutely held millions of Germans right in his palm. He swayed their minds and their emotions and caused them to find an outlet in their own frustrations, in his personal aspirations of greatness for the German Volk. And today Germany, morgen die Welt, tomorrow the world. And you see what they did, drenched all of Europe and the world in blood and caused the life of somewhere between 60 and 70 million human beings during World War II, mercilessly butchered about 6 million Jews. One evil man. I have no doubt that from time to time, if not from a certain time throughout an entire period of time, the devil personally entered in to Adolf Hitler. It's one way I can cope or understand, knowing what I do about the Word of God and the Bible, as to how some human beings can act the way they do. So, you look at these people teaching their little children this kind of garbage, and it just is absolutely frightening to deal with. Let's go to Christ's warnings about twisted, perverted, false religions. Matthew 7, 15 to 21. Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, but inwardly they are ravening wolves. Now, this kind of false prophet knows what he is. There's never been a prostitute in church that didn't know what she was. People don't become self-deceived about things like that. So when Jesus says, inwardly they are ravening wolves, that means what? A wolf is hungry for the sheep, hungry for sheep's blood. He wants to dine on sheep's flesh. So the wolves want to rip off the sheep. They want the hide and the wool and the life and the blood and everything else, and that is their goal and their aim. You shall know them by their fruits, by what they produce. Do men gather grapes of thorns or figs of thistles? Even so, every good tree brings forth good fruit, but a corrupt tree brings forth evil fruit. A good tree cannot bring forth evil fruit, neither can a corrupt tree bring forth good fruit. Every tree that brings not forth good fruit is hewn down and cast into the fire. And that is, of course, an analogy of being cast into Gehenna fire. Wherefore, by their fruits you shall know them. What were the fruits of Jim Jones' ministry? Over 900 people drinking cyanide or whatever, strychnine, and dying in a bloody flux in a mass suicide pact because that egocentric idiot couldn't bear to take his own life without everybody that was with him going along for the trip. Unbelievable that people can swallow that kind of stuff. But I remember a woman that told my sister one time that if a certain minister told her to jump out a four-story window, she'd do it. Now that's mind control beyond what I can begin to imagine. That is exactly saying that if this woman, had she been in the place of Jesus Christ, and Satan the devil would say, well, go ahead and jump off the parapet of the temple because it is written, the angels will bear thee up lest you dash your foot against a stone. She wouldn't say, get thee hence, Satan. You should not tempt the Lord thy God. She'd do it. Are there fanatics like that around us? Oh, there's an Islamic cultural society right here in Tyler, Texas. every good weather day that I'm out and about, I've got them 2 and 3 airplanes at a time flying over my head, learning to fly airplanes. Let me tell you, already in the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks that they've been here on a 14-week period of learning how to fly, those guys know enough right now to steer an airplane into a massive building or a nuclear plant. They've got enough knowledge right now on how to steer an airplane, but they're also learning how to take off and land. I don't know that they're terrorists. I'm just saying that if they're not, they could be, and the terrorists are not going to tell you the truth. When you query them, are you a terrorist? Oh, yeah, I'm learning to, you know, I'm going to crash into the White House someday. That isn't what happened. I mean, even the various manuals that they have found that the terrorists had in their possession have information in there about how to fake a story and how to lie and how to appear being absolutely bland and unthreatening. By the way, you heard about the judge that let the one guy go that was arrested as a material witness. He's already been let go. I think it was he's back in San Diego, and a New Jersey judge let him go. In his possession were books and stuff from bin Laden on martyrdom. There were at least 3 telephone numbers and addresses of at least 3 of the guys who died. He actually worked at a car wash alongside them and knew them. All of this was there. He's only a 21-year-old, and the judge let him go. Now, there's something about this in the United States of America I want to deal with. If you'll go to Ezekiel, the 2nd chapter, you've heard about Americans being independent, and we really prize our freedoms, and we get all bent out of sort when someone seems to be imposing upon them. But sometimes that almost gets at a point of individual anarchy, where people adopt the concept, no one is going to tell me what to do. I had that concept when I was about 17 or 18, because I was rebelling against an authoritative father. So as I've joked about myself in the past, I joined the Navy to get out from under authority. And I found out very, very quickly that a lot of people could tell me what to do, and all I could do was say, yes, sir, and do it. But I didn't expect that to be quite as bad as it was. In the first chapter of Ezekiel is the great vision that he sees, which was the throne of God. And it says in the last part of verse 28 of chapter 1, this was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of the Lord, or the Eternal. And when I saw it, I fell upon my face, and I heard a voice of one that spake. And he said unto me, Son of man, stand upon thy feet, and I will speak unto thee. And the Spirit entered into me when he spake unto me, and set me upon my feet. And I heard him that spake, and he said unto me, and he said, Son of man, I send you to the children of Israel, to a rebellious nation that has rebelled against me. They and their fathers have transgressed against me, even unto this very day. Who is the I? Who is the me here? For they are impudent children and stiff-hearted. Interesting that certainly is true of the Jewish race, just as a statement about a carnal, unconverted Jew, not a converted one. I do send you unto them, and you shall say to them, Thus says the Lord God. So the I that sends him, that says, I send you, they've transgressed against me, is the one we know of as Jesus Christ of Nazareth, who is commissioning Ezekiel as his prophet. And they, whether they will hear or whether they will forbear, so it doesn't matter if they hear or they reject, for they are a rebellious house, he's reminded again, yet shall they know that there has been a prophet among them. God is not going to leave them with any excuses. They will not be left without a witness. They cannot say, but no one ever told me. They've got to have a warning. And thou, son of man, be not afraid of them. I'm not afraid of the stupid Muslims who might want to kill me. I'm not a bit afraid of them. I'm not going to live my life in fear. And I'm going to speak out fearlessly about false religions. Hey, I have attacked, if you want to use that term, every false religion that I know of for the last 46 years. And 99% of the time, they have been false Protestant and or Catholic religions, and I have spent very little time in the past 46 years exposing the evils of Islam. Now, haven't I? Some of you have been sitting out there in the Feast of Tabernacles in the 1950s and 60s can say, that's right. You didn't hear me inveighing much against Islam back in 1955 or 63 or 72, did you? But now I see the evils that it is actually creating around this earth, and it's time that it was labeled exactly what it is. Be not afraid of them, neither be afraid of their words, though briars and thorns be with thee, and you dwell among scorpions. Be not afraid of their words, nor be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. And you shall speak my words unto them, whether they will hear or whether they forbear. It doesn't matter. You witness to them anyway. For they are most rebellious. But thou, son of man, hear what I say unto thee. Be not thou rebellious like that rebellious house. Open your mouth and eat what I give thee. And there was a little book filled with mourning, lamentations, and woe. And figuratively, maybe there was a little thing like a sugar roll or something that he ate, but it says that it was filled with mourning, lamentations, and woe. And he opened his mouth, and it said it caused him to eat and fill his bowels with a roll. Verse 2, he ate it. It was sweetness as honey when he tasted it. And he said, verse 4, now this is either symbolic of receiving and imbibing the message so it became an actual part of him, or it was actually both. He said, son of man, go get you unto the house of Israel. This was 121 years after the house of Israel had gone into captivity. He was among the captives of Judah by the river Kabur, which was probably a term that meant Heber, by a river, which is one of the tributaries that drains into the Tigris or the Euphrates rivers up in Kurdistan and northern Iraq. And it was a temporary concentration camp. The 12 tribes of Israel had long since disappeared and been dispersed. And yet this prophecy comes to him 121 years after Israel had been taken into captivity. That's why I've always known that Ezekiel is a book written for our time now. Because Ezekiel never got to Egypt, but their prophecies go speak to Egypt. He never got to Ammon or Edom, but there are prophecies against Edom and Moab and Ammon. He never went there. He wasn't given diplomatic immunity and a passport and traveled all over the world taking messages to people. He just wrote it, and it's been preserved, and the messages never got to the people for whom they were intended. And so it is for our day. And every time you see a statement in the book of Ezekiel, and it's pretty much only in the book of Ezekiel in that language, and it says it over and over and over again, and they shall know that I am the Eternal. It says it over and over again. Let me just show you that chapter 6. Turn to that right quickly. Verse 7. The slain shall fall in the midst of you, and you shall know that I am the Lord. Verse 13. Then shall you know that I am the Lord. Chapter 7, verse 9, the last line. You shall know that I am the Lord that smiteth. Over and over and over again. He is going to do this to his people, his chosen people, and he says, then you'll know that I am God, that I did it. Now I want to show you something in the third chapter, verse 7 to 9. This is the house of Israel again. The house of Israel will not hearken unto thee, for they will not hearken unto me. For all the house of Israel are impudent and hard-hearted. Behold, I have made your face strong against their faces, and your forehead strong against their foreheads. As adamant, and adamant like flint, a very strong rock, harder than flint have I made your forehead. Fear them not, neither be dismayed at their looks, though they be a rebellious house. You know, the United States of America, even in the very beginning of our roots in the 13 colonies, have always been a people who rebel against authoritarian governments. That has been carried to such an extreme today that there are among us hundreds of domestic cells, organizations. Almost every state has its militia. I don't think every state militia has any evil intentions of overthrowing the government, but there are still plenty of anti-government conspiracy theorists out there. Just because of what happened on 9/11, they didn't disappear. Timothy McVeigh did do what he did. There are a lot of people who still think that every one of the presidents is just like they're all the same person. They don't just blame Clinton and say, now we've got a completely new and a different government. We've got Rumsfeld in there and so on. We've got all kinds of people instead of Janet Reno and so on. No, it's all just a big government conspiracy. They're all in on it. They all know about it. They're all the same people. They're all Masons or they're something else. And they're the conspiracy theorists all over the place. And they hate government. Really, deep down inside, they are anarchists. They don't want to recognize any authority except an authority that they themselves would have or would possess. Now look what's happening in Afghanistan today. If you think a provisional government is going to work, think again. Because the men that are going back in there to Kandahar and Kabul are warlords, and they have these young thugs, every one of them sporting a Kalashnikov K-47, AK-47, with a couple of bandoliers of ammunition, and they are already saying they're not going to go along with this that was decided in Bonn the other day. And so by the time the Taliban fades into the woodwork, even keeping their weapons and just biding their time, blending into the populace, going back to where they came from and sitting around waiting for it to happen again, which they're going to be plotting and planning on, each one of the warlords will want his own little cadre of his armed gang and thugs and try to have absolute power where he can tax those people and he can have the greatest house and all the women and all the food and the clothing and everything that he wants, just like a feudal baron of some kind, because that's what it is. It's feudalism over there. And all of that fractious kind of a situation is already rearing its ugly head. And if you think that all of a sudden a nice democracy, kind of an Americanization of Afghanistan, is going to happen, and the next 10 or 15 years it'll all be peace and plenty and prosperity, why, I'd probably see a Walmart in every little village. It'd be just everybody be having a little Toyota to drive around. Forget it. It is not going to happen. Folks of the church and everybody that sees and hears this tape, we are at war. We're at war. It is a spiritual war. It is a global war. It is a war for total stakes. It is a war for the domination of the world. It is a war against all mankind. And guess who's going to win it? Jesus Christ of Nazareth. And what I'm telling you is there is no human solution. There is no human solution. The United Nations? Kofi Annan? Have you got faith in him? You got faith in the United Nations? You think they're going to solve it? What about EU? They're going to solve it? Can't believe what Tony Blair did the other day. He signed legislation that has got half of the British people or more absolutely on their ear, insanely angry, because in order to fight terrorism, he went along with legislation in the EU which actually allows EU authorities outside of England to arrest British citizens for perceived violations of EU laws, which are not the same as British laws, so that a British citizen can commit an act. For example, he could be accused of harboring xenophobia and being a racist. He can be arrested by an EU authority when it isn't against the law in England. So I am amazed that Tony Blair has gone that far and is giving up that much of British sovereignty. I'm amazed. But that is happening. I want to go to Matthew, the 10th chapter, where Jesus Christ sent out his disciples and gave them exactly what they're going to be looking at, what they're going to have to face. Behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be you therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they will deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogue. Interesting that he said the place where this brutality will take place is in the churches, in the synagogue. So this is a religious authority doing this. And what is a Taliban? Remember I told you, Taliban means disciples. And what they were trying to impose upon these people is the very same thing, ever more protracted, ever more applicable, ever more detailed and reaching into every nuance of human behavior, thought, and dress, that would have been imposed upon a whole church organization, and in fact almost was, by some of the young, wild-eyed fanatics among the worldwide church in the 1950s. You have no idea how many arranged marriages failed. You have no idea how many people succumbed to that kind of mind control and had wretched lives as a result of it. I know because I was back there very much a young, wide-eyed idealist at that time where all kinds of decisions were made about personal choices on people's lives. And I can tell you that if people like that, and you go look at the Hutterites, and they're probably good people, okay, but I don't agree with their dress styles and with their communal kind of life. Look at the Amish. I don't agree with their religion. But they're hard-working, good, honest people, and they're wonderful family people, and they keep their children in control, and you can say all kinds of marvelous things about them. Look at the Mormons. They almost do not lose any of their children. They've got strong family structure, and they're good people. They're probably honest neighbors and so on. But I absolutely believe that, like the science fiction believers of the so-called Christian religion, that their religion is almost like science fiction, being baptized for the dead, the idea that a Moroni, very unfortunate choice of a name for an archangel, Moroni, anyway, came over here, and that Joseph Smith allegedly found these plates. Unfortunately for them, some idiot decided to translate them in 1611 King James English instead of in modern American at the time. But be that as it may, they've got this religion called the Book of Mormon. It's absolutely fantasy. It is not true at all. It was concocted and made up by this guy, just like Muhammad made up his religion. But they're good people. I mean, there are millions of them. The whole state of Utah is Mormon. They have been in the cabinets of presidents. They've been the head of the agriculture department and so on. And they're good men, good women, good people. You could trust them as neighbors, but they don't have the truth. And they have swallowed something that is absolutely disprovable to any rational thinking person who's willing to do the research. And so I'm saying that there are people who are giving their minds over into thought control and mind control by leaders of various false religions, and there are people who are listening to the preachments to these mullahs in their mosques who are being told that their only way to heaven, which I read to you there, is by shedding your blood and mine. And the more of us they can kill, I guess the greater their reward. I mean, to promise somebody after his body is blasted into bits endless sex with 72 virgins is one of the dumbest, all-time stupidest things I've ever heard. And for somebody to swallow that kind of stuff is just unbelievable. But then there was Jim Jones. And there were these suicidal people in San Diego. And there were these terrorists who flew those airplanes into the Twin Trade Towers. So you have to deal with it. It's out here, it's everywhere, it's in the world, and it's happening. Now, it says that they're going to hate God's people. Beware of men. They will deliver you up to the councils and scourge you, beat you in their synagogue. And you'll be brought before governors and kings for my sake for a testimony against them and the nations. But when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what you shall speak. For it shall be given you in that same hour what you shall speak. For it is not you that speak, but the Spirit of your Father that speaks in you. And the brother shall deliver up the brother to death. That has happened in the past. Sometimes people just decide that a few more weeks or months or years of this human physical life is worth more than their beloved brother. And the father, the child, and the children shall rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. And you shall be hated of all men for my name's sake. Why? You ever ask yourself, why is that? The way I read my Bible, I'm supposed to turn the other cheek. I'm supposed to love even my enemies. I'm supposed to be good and kind and decent and gentle. I'm supposed to be honest. I'm supposed to be hardworking. I'm supposed to be thrifty. I'm supposed to be faithful and loyal. I'm supposed to have all these wonderful qualities, to be meek and to be caring and to be serving. I look at the teachings of Jesus Christ, of what he said about the Roman mailman, or what he said about someone that smites you on the face, turn to him the other also. Why would anyone hate anyone who believes in that way of life? Well, if that's all there is to it, I don't think there's any reason for them to hate them. But if what there is an awful lot more that is beyond that, that doesn't really come into light, such as the fact that they do not believe in the real Jesus at all, but in Satan the devil masquerading as a false Christ. That they don't believe in the day that God made holy at all and reject it wholesale because they are as adamant as flint and because they are hard-headed and hard-hearted and because they just have these excuses. Well, look how many of us, though, are going along the way with the mass, with the line of least resistance, with all the glorious churches. Surely all these churches can't be wrong. I've been there, done that. I know exactly what that argument feels like. I used to drive my mother to tears with it. Who gives him the right to be right? So I had to come at it from a different point of view. I had to decide whether or not there is a God and can you prove it? Whether or not the Bible is his word and can you prove it? And then I began to read things that were written by false teachers that actually were twisting and wresting the Bible. Like, for example, a chapter in The Great Controversy by Mrs. E.G. White out of the 24th chapter of Isaiah that actually puts a period where there's a comma and few men left and omits it from the chapter, which would destroy her entire doctrine. When I saw this, when I see people always stopping, lest any man should boast, in Ephesians 2:8, and not going on, for we are His workmanship, created in Christ Jesus, unto good works, which God hath before ordained that we should walk in them, I say, wait a minute. Somebody's playing games with the Scriptures here. They're not being honest. Surely you can't have that kind of tunnel vision. You couldn't have even stumbled upon the fact there's a verse following verse 8. And read a couple of more verses in the context? When I would see this in little booklets that were trying to debunk the law of God, and then I look at John 1 and Hebrews 1 and prove beyond a shadow of a doubt, and with a bayonet already that far right in here, headed toward my heart, I would say, go ahead. But John 1 says that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is the God of the Old Testament. And having proved that to myself, I know from that and many, many other proofs, was the law in force and in effect before Sinai? Yes. Is it going to be in force and in effect at the time of Christ's arrival on the earth? What is the first great edict? The Feast of Tabernacles? Yes. Does Christ change? No. Does God ever change? No. Did Jesus Christ lift the Ten Commandments to a broader application and a spiritual principle applying into the thoughts of human minds rather than merely human action? Yes. Has the law been done away? No. Is the Sabbath still in effect? Yes. Didn't Christ say, and the time setting is in the tribulation, just before the heavenly signs, when people are to flee for their lives and not even come down out of the housetop, that they are to pray for what? That their flight be neither in the winter nor on the Sabbath day. Why would they be concerned about a Sabbath day's journey at the end of the time of the tribulation? Unless he thought the Sabbath is still important. But that's only one of many proofs. And there are many, many of them. Isaiah 56, Exodus 31, the fourth chapter of Hebrews, therefore there remaineth a sabbatismos, or a keeping of the Sabbath to the people of God. So, I'm looking back at my own childhood. I'm looking at the childhood of Osama bin Laden and all of his ilk. I'm looking at the childhood of these little Arab kids in over 30 or 40 nations all over the world who are being taught and programmed with the kind of garbage I read to you a few minutes ago, by the mullahs in the mosques that get these kids fixated on death. And unlike you and unlike me, they don't want to put off death. They want to rush up and grab hold of it. They want to rush up and embrace it. They want it to come to them in as smashing and violent and mass murderous a method as they can possibly make it happen. They want to take out as many Jews and Americans, especially, as they possibly can. And as they see the blood start to spurt, as it says there, by the time the first drop of blood spurts, they will be given this vision of these 72 virgins, and they will know, even as their body is being mashed or blown up or disintegrated, and before the soul leaves the body, they will know that they're going into this wonderful paradise. Now, I guess when you sit around on camel dung, I guess when you sit around in a wretched, filthy country with mud hovels, I guess when your life is just wretched and miserable, you sit on the floor with no furniture, I guess when there are only like, you know, one doctor for every 15, 20,000 people and one bicycle for a village of 350 people, I suppose that since this life is so wretched and so miserable and so bereft of any creature comforts, that the picture that they paint of 72 virgins and wonderful silks and lounge areas and fruit hanging down so low you just reach up and pluck the succulent grape like Caesar with his wine goblet, I suppose that it's easy to subvert impressionable young minds with that kind of garbage and get them saying, oh yes, I want some of that. And that's what's happening, isn't it? It is a war for the minds of human beings, and Satan the devil is, I believe, come down with great wrath because he knows that he has but a short time. Now to complete this, and just to say one thing to throw in here real quickly, the Pope has now spoken out. The Pope has called all of the Monsignors, the top Vatican embassy or ambassadors from the Middle East, from Jordan, from Israel, from other countries around. They're all in the Vatican right now today. They're having a meeting over there. And he's calling for peace. He's very upset about all the attacks by the Israelis. I don't know that he's condemned very much the attacks by the Palestinians, but he's upset about it. He's worried about the defacing, interesting language, of the holy places, the defacing of the Holy Land. Bin Laden's worried about the defacing of the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia and wants us out of there, and the Pope's worried about the defacing of the old city of Jerusalem. So when I see Germany flexing its muscles, and I learned only 2 or 3 days ago that not only in humanitarian efforts and not only in C-130s, not only in having their AWACS aircraft circulating out over the Atlantic by Washington, D.C. and New York City, because we don't have enough to keep track of our own air traffic control for the F-16s that are daily flying over our air traffic in the East Coast. We got German AWACS aircraft over there. I found out just middle of last week that German special forces are also on the ground in Afghanistan. And of course, the meeting for the new provisional government took place in Bonn, Germany. And now the Pope is speaking out. It's going to be interesting to watch. You know what the parameters are. You know what to watch for. But certainly we are to watch. And I think if you would contrast your own experience with those people and come to understand how it is that anyone can get into a mindset like some of these suicidal Islamic fundamentalists who want to kill every last one of us, maybe you can learn a little something, and maybe it'll strengthen your own resolve never, never to be dissuaded from the course upon which you have set yourself, and to be a member of the true church of God. It says in the 12th chapter of the book of Daniel that those who turn many to righteousness will shine like the stars forever and ever. I would rather be involved in God's work, doing God's will, fulfilling my purpose in life, and knowing what I know about church politics and about playing church and about these idiotic, irrational, stupid, satanic, false religions, and just speak the truth no matter what it costs me at whatever point in time, than do anything else that I could ever remotely imagine. You couldn't hold out to me any career, any amount of money, any venue, any place on the face of the earth that you could tempt me with, whether Hawaii, the Bahamas, or the South Island of New Zealand, and say, wouldn't you like to go there with $20 million to spend? I'd say, forget it. Go chuck it in the lake. I'm going to keep doing the work of God every single day.